So this news about the destiny of the Khawarij is one of the miracles of Imam Ali alayhi salam, that Ibn Abil Hadid says in his Sharh of Nahjul Balagha, Ibn Abil Hadid says that it was this news by Imam Ali alayhi salam that only 10 of the not more than 10 people from amongst the Khawarij will be left,
right.
And from amongst the believers, the forces of Imam Ali alayhi salam, not more than 10 people will be martyred.
All right.
So in the final analysis, only 9 of the Khawarij were able to save their lives and to save themselves from this battle and leave this battle without having died or
That's
being
right.
killed.
Okay.
But and only 8 of the forces of the of Imam Ali alayhi salam were martyred in the process. So Ibn Abil Hadid says that this this is a miracle of Imam Ali alayhi salam, that he could predict even before the battle that where we are going to meet these forces of the Khawarij. He said that we are going to meet them next to the river of Nehravan.
Yes.
Next to the river of Nehravan, and this is going to be the place where all of them will be killed, but only not more than 10 people would be able to save their lives. And from amongst you, not more than 10 will be martyred. And so Ibn Abil Hadid says that this is a miracle of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and this was a news that was narrated by Tawatur. All the forces there were assembled. They heard this news and they related this to the generations after.
Well, one of the people who fled the scene was Abdurrahman ibn Muljam al-Muradi.
Yes, and so one of the
killer of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
The person who killed Imam Ali alayhi salam was one of these Khawarij who saved his life during the battle of Nehravan. Okay.
That's right. That's it. So true predictions of Imam Ali came true. And there is a nice, some of the nice sentences after the Nahrawan battle is done. Imam Ali alayhi salam comes and visits the corpse of the killed people over there. And in a sermon, he says that, woe unto you who were deceived by Satan and the satanic temptations and those who deceived you, okay?
True.
We know who is referring to, okay? So whoever we can say that's right. And finally, you'll be burnt in the hellfire because of your mistakes and your temptations, satanic temptations. So all in all, we could say that from the very beginning, Imam Ali knew that what will happen at the end, what would be the result be, okay? And as you said, according to Saim, we can say that's right. Commentators of the hadith or something like that, this shows the Ladunni knowledge, isn't it?
Of
the
course.
Divine knowledge of Ali ibn Abi Talib about the unseen world and the invisible world.
Yes, and we can say that this was one of the miracles and it has been narrated in a lot of traditions, so that Ibn Abil Hadid says that this is a news that has been narrated by Tawatur for later generations. And this is not only the first instance of such a news that has been narrated by Imam Ali alayhi salam telling about future events. For example, regarding Marwan ibn Hakam, also, he was taken as a prisoner in the Battle of Jamal. And Imam Ali alayhi salam, because of the wisata or of Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he was forgiven.
Yeah.
Marwan ibn Hakam. And Imam Ali alayhi salam said that this Marwan that you see here, he is going to enjoy a caliphate for how long? For only that long that a dog licks his nose or his face. So only for a very short time. And his sons will also become your rulers. And this would be a very bloody period in Muslim history. And so we see that Marwan ibn Hakam becomes the ruler of the Muslim community for 9 months.
Yes.
And his son, whose name is Abdul Malik ibn Marwan, he becomes the caliph, and 3 of his brothers become the walis or the governors of Misr, of Egypt, of Iraq, and Jazeera.
That's right.
And so this prediction of Imam Ali alayhi salam also comes true. And during this time, this was one of the bloodiest times for the Muslim community, because another governor of theirs, Hajjaj ibn Yusuf, was operative during this time.
That's right. And when you look at the battles of Imam Ali alayhi salam, against whom? I mean, against the people who were deviated from the right path of true successorship of Imam Ali alayhi salam, Jang-e Jamal, we can say Talha and Zubair, believed to be the greatest companions of Prophet Muhammad, again in Safin, Muawiyah, and again Kharijites, okay?
Yeah.
So Ali alayhi salam was the main standard, in fact, in order to understand what is the true Muhammadi Islam, or the pure Muhammadan Islam.
Yes.
On that time. I mean, these wars and results were not like mere wars that we could see in all other parts of the world because of the power. They were, in fact, a distinguishing line between truth and falsehood.
And falsehood.
Yeah.
Yes. That's and right. A very pertinent point that you pointed out, that if we want to understand the history of the early Islamic period, when we see the stances of the different Muslims, we clearly see that there is the camp of Imam Ali alayhi salam, the Shia to Aliyin, and the Shia of the other camp.
All right.
So this train of thought is there. If we want to understand Islamic history, we could understand from the stances of Imam Ali alayhi salam that what was the Islamic injunctions, the true Islam is being represented by Imam Ali alayhi salam, and his enemies or those who fight with him are representing deviations from the true Islam, the Muhammadi Islam, or the divine religion of Islam.
That's right. Thank you very much, Sheikh. It was very kind of you. Your details about the Nahrawan battle and the true predictions of Imam Ali alayhi salam that came true on that time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, please visit our website, iranradio.ir. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban Ali wa Husayn wa Hasan. Li Ali wa Husayn wa Hasan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي
South Africa's iconic freedom fighter and first democratically elected leader Nelson Mandela once remarked, "We know too well that our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of the Palestinians." So how can the International Quds Day be utilized as a strategic platform to further Mandela's vision of a free Palestine and work towards realizing his dream? And to discuss the International Quds Day and Africa's support for the liberation of Palestine, we are joined by Dr. Feroz Osman. He is the executive member of Media Review Network. We are also joined by Hassan Loget. He is the co-founder of Media Justice Africa. The International Quds Day is observed annually on the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan. Established by Imam Khomeini in 1979, this popular occasion serves as a global expression of solidarity with the Palestinian people in their struggle against the Israeli apartheid regime and its ongoing atrocities. Quds Day has united voices worldwide in support of Palestine, and today, Africa has emerged as a formidable resistance force against the Israeli genocidal regime. Despite intense U.S. pressure and Israeli attempts to infiltrate the continent, Africa's resistance continues to strengthen. Countries like South Africa, drawing from their own anti-apartheid struggle, are at the forefront of resisting the Israeli apartheid regime. South Africa's genocide case against Israel at the International Court of Justice further cements Africa's role as a leading advocate for Palestinian liberation. Africa is proving that solidarity with Palestine is more than symbolic. It is a firm commitment to dismantling the Israeli apartheid regime. So how can the International Quds Day be utilized as a powerful platform to advance Nelson Mandela's vision of a free Palestine and turn his call for justice into meaningful action on the global stage?
Africa backs Quds liberation.
Each year on the International Quds Day, large-scale demonstrations take place across Africa in support of Palestine. Home to one-third of the global Muslim population, the continent sees hundreds of thousands joining the worldwide movement advocating for Palestine's liberation. A participant at one of the demonstrations held in the coastal city of Mombasa in Kenya speaks here on the importance of standing with the oppressed people of Palestine.
We should not be ashamed to stand with the oppressors if our hearts are burning, but we keep away from the people who are oppressed. We can't even raise the voices. Then shame on us. We have one thing left on us, and that's our voice. And if we come out, we should claim this occupation no more and not say Israel is a free state, but Israel is a no state, because it was a usurped land of the Palestinians, given by the British. The Balfour Declaration gave them land that doesn't belong to them. Why? Because they wanted to get rid of the Jews that were there. Anyway, thank you very much for listening to me, but please, I would request you, echo this out. Remind the people of the world that the oppressed need your voices.
The observance of the International Quds Day, established in 1979 by Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, has become a global tradition of marches and conferences advocating for the Palestinian cause. His appeal for global solidarity continues to resonate worldwide. Africa is part and parcel of this international movement in support of Palestine. Now, let's start off with Dr. Firoz Osman. How has the International Quds Day contributed to raising awareness about the Palestinian liberation struggle across the African continent?
The Iranian Revolution in 1979 was a true revolution. In other words, many of the other revolutions that have taken place did not remove the institutions and the deep state. For example, what happened in Egypt. You know, it lasted a year and then it was overthrown again. And the old systems and the controllers came back in power. So it is probably in recent memory, the only true revolution. And it is quite remarkable for Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, that in 1979, he already declared Al-Quds Day. It showed their determination to free the third most holiest shrine. And it is a day that has been commemorated now ever since 45 years or plus. And it has created a global phenomenon, not only in Africa, as we mentioned, but throughout the world, where Palestine has been brought up into the map. Many others are gaining, given under the current circumstances, what is happening in Gaza, that they are getting courage from what has been happening in Gaza. There is no doubt that, you know, it is Iran that stands against the world system that wants to occupy and oppress people, and it is the Palestinians in Gaza that is fighting the same phenomenon with a great deal of courage, looking to Al-Quds for their liberation, to all countries that are helping them. And in fact, you know, it is the protest marches that began right in Iran in 1979 that continues till this day.
Thanks for that, Dr. Osman. Now let's bring in Hassan Loget. At the 30th African Union Summit held in Addis Ababa last February, African leaders took a strong position against Israel, denouncing its assault on Gaza as genocide and demanding a halt to all cooperation until the Israeli occupation ends. Now, how does Africa's steadfast support for Palestine pose a significant challenge to Netanyahu, who has spent the past decade working to expand Israel's influence across the continent?
The 38th African summit, the AU summit, held in Addis, was very significant because it suggested for the first time that Africa was uniting once again behind Palestine. We have to go back many decades, I think in the early 1980s, when the Organization of African Unity was at its height, trying to create a program for the liberation of the African continent from colonialism and apartheid, that they made a statement in the founding declaration of the African People's Charter, African Charter for Human and People's Rights. And that charter, also known as the Banjul document, was very, very instrumental in putting Zionism as one of the targets. And I wanted to quote a little bit of it. The charter basically said they wanted to achieve the total liberation of Africa, of peoples which are still struggling for their dignity and genuine independence, and undertaking to eliminate colonialism, neo-colonialism, apartheid, and Zionism, and to dismantle aggressive foreign military bases and all forms of discrimination, particularly those based on race, ethnic groups, color, sex, language, religion, or political opinion. So it looks like this was a victory for the progressive forces led by South Africa and Algeria.
Ties between the Israeli apartheid regime and the African Union significantly worsen after Israel's assault on Gaza in October 2023, which led to mass atrocities and genocide, resulting in the deaths of over 50,000 Palestinian women and children. Across Africa, people have gathered in massive numbers for rallies in solidarity with Palestine, especially during International Quds Day. These demonstrations impacted the African Union's policy decisions.
The African Union is pivotal. It is important for increasing pressure on the Zionist entity. If we recall, way back in 1973, most African countries, almost all bar one or two, broke their ties after the oil embargo in support of the Palestinians, in support of the Arab world. However, the Zionist entity's aim is to bring about a change in Africa, in the African nation states, through the observer status in the African Union. We know a year or two ago that South Africa played a pivotal role to remove the Zionist entity from its observer status in the African Union, despite the fact that some of the African Union member states wanted Israel to be present. You see, what the Zionist state does is to use its soft power, its technology, its military, where they bribe and blackmail and trying to influence the African nation states to support Israel against the Palestinians. And this is where, again, the Iranian Islamic Republic of Iran has played an important role. It is also important for other Muslim nations to be aware of what is happening in parts of Africa and to help the African nations to ward off the soft power that the Zionist entity is using.
Many African countries are actively forging stronger ties with global powers that challenge Western dominance, such as China, Russia, and Iran. These alliances grant them greater political leverage, enabling them to take more independent stances on international matters, including the Palestinian issue. The evolving geopolitical landscape has played a key role in further isolating Israel's apartheid regime in Africa.
Where you find Israel, you'll find conflict. And I think that the countries that want to turn away from conflict have to find a path of peace and are looking for other ways. In the Sahel region, a number of countries have kicked off the leadership military alliances with France. But as I pointed out earlier, we need to negotiate new terms of engagement and relationships with countries like Russia, and so that we do not find ourselves a few years down the line with someone that we cannot live with. We need to live with countries that will affirm African values so that Africa can use its own minerals for its betterment. And we can't replace one set of dictators for another. So yes, getting France out has been strategic, but Africa must renegotiate its terms of engagement with other countries on its own politics, its own agenda that's African-centric. And Kwame Nkrumah was very, very clear that Africa's got a long way to build a United States of Africa where all our resources could be used to uplift our own people.
The comparison between the Israeli regime policies towards Palestinians and the deposed South African apartheid regime has been made by both scholars and political leaders. Now, Dr. Osman, this is for you. In what ways do you see these parallels playing out today, particularly because Western powers, which once supported the apartheid regime in South Africa, are now backing the Israeli apartheid regime?
South Africa under apartheid is exactly the same as apartheid in Israel. And this is said very clearly by our first president, Nelson Mandela. It was said by our moral voice in South Africa, Bishop Tutu. In fact, they didn't say it's exactly the same. They say what is going on in Israel is worse than what has happened in South Africa. That the apartheid there is worse. And we can see it from the genocide. In fact, the Media Review Network commissioned a book, and it is entitled Why Israel? The Anatomy of Zionist Apartheid, a South African Perspective, where it makes very clear the parallels between what was under apartheid in South Africa and what is apartheid in Israel at the moment. And in fact, it's become so obvious that it is no longer a debatable issue. The reason for the support of Zionist apartheid is that the same countries that supported white apartheid racism in South Africa are supporting the Zionist Israeli state, such as Germany, United States of America, Great Britain, France. All of them supported white South Africa until it became untenable, until they could no longer control it and could not stop it. So these are the same racist, white settler, colonial regimes that are supporting Israel today. And in fact, we can see that what is going on with the Trump administration today, that it is white settler colonialism.
Well, thanks for that, Dr. Osman. Let's now take a short break before we continue our discussion on Africa's solidarity with Palestine as we mark the International Quds Day. Stay with us.
Africa backs Quds liberation.
In late 2023, South Africa filed a case at the International Court of Justice over the Israeli apartheid regime's genocidal war on Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip. Ron Lamola, the current South African foreign minister, speaks here at the ICJ, where he led his country's legal team while serving as the Minister of Justice and Correctional Services. Let's take a listen.
Thank you, Madam President, and distinguished members of the court. It is an honor for me to stand here in front of you on behalf of the Republic of South Africa on this exceptional case. In extending our hands across the miles to the people of Palestine, we do so in full knowledge that we are part of a humanity that is at one. These were the words of our founding president, Nelson Mandela. This is the spirit in which South Africa acceded to the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Crime of Genocide in 1998. This is the spirit in which we approach this court as a contracting party to the Convention. This is a commitment we owe to the people of Palestine and Israelis alike. As previously mentioned, the violence and the destruction in Palestine and Israel did not begin on the 7th of October 2023. The Palestinians have experienced systematic oppression and violence for the last 76 years.
Well, South Africa's case at the International Court of Justice has been described as both a legal and moral stance against the genocide in Gaza. Now, Mr. Logan, this is for you. How significant is this moment for South Africa's history, given its own past with apartheid, and how does it shape its role in global justice and human rights advocacy?
We have to find whatever means possible to preserve a sensible system in the world, a system of equality amongst nations, so that the rule of law, international human rights law, can actually prevail. At present, Trump wants might to rule, not justice, might. And I think South Africa is correct in building these alliances. Our ambassador was declared a persona non grata in America, and Trump has basically asked him to leave the country. This is Ibrahim Rasool, for simply speaking at a web conference in this country, Mistra, where he basically said that Trump and him are fearing the increasing numbers of black and brown peoples in the world, in America, that are beginning to have influence. And he implied that they were trying to preserve white supremacist politics. None of that is untrue, but he's chosen to punish South Africa. So Trump and him are being vindictive, not only to South Africa, but anyone who dared to oppose them, even people in his own party. But South Africa is being bullied. Unfortunately, there are a number of people in our country who actually support Trump, and they happen to be from those who are privileged, happen to be largely white.
Julius Malema, the leader of South Africa's Economic Freedom Fighters Party, frequently takes part in demonstrations backing the Palestinian resistance. In this speech, he expresses his support for Hamas, the Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement. Let's tune in.
What type of a government do we have in Israel that goes and bombs a hospital where people have run away for refugee, where people are sick, where children are there, where pregnant women are there? You bomb a hospital and you say you are looking for Hamas, but you are killing innocent children. There is nothing wrong Hamas did. This folk tongues and people speaking in parables and we don't know what they are hearing, what they are saying, it's wrong. When you are oppressed, the only option you have is to fight. And that's what Hamas is doing. They are fighting for their freedom. Mandela did the same thing, took up the guns and fought for the freedom of the people of South Africa. When you are oppressed, you only have one option. Confront the enemy and shoot to kill. Do not kiss the enemy.
South Africa's liberation hero, Nelson Mandela, became known and respected all over the world as a symbol of the struggle against apartheid and all forms of racism. He was steadfast in his support for the liberation of Palestine. He famously stated that, "We know too well that our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of the Palestinians."
Mr. Logat, you have the last one. How can events like the International Quilts Day be leveraged as a platform to advance Nelson Mandela's vision of a free Palestine and turn his aspiration into a reality?
When the late president, liberation hero Nelson Mandela said, "Our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of Palestinians," he basically drew inspiration from the time when the ANC in exile was trained and supported by the Palestinian Liberation Organization. It was a unity built in the trenches. And when he went to America, they tried to ask him to disassociate from Arafat and the PLO and Fatah. And he said, when days were dark and friends were few, only Palestinians, Libya, and other countries stood by us while others ignored us. And really, this is the message of Sumud, as the Palestinians say, the steadfastness that Iran and other countries, the Houthis, Lebanon and others, have been very principled in their support for Palestine. Cuba too, they want nothing in return. They support it not because they desire critical minerals, as Trump wants, from the Ukraine. They support it because they believe every nation has a right to determine its own destiny. Every nation has a right to self-determination. And we have fought a long battle, and we are still continuing, given the nature of our settlement, and we want to lend a hand so that Palestine one day can be a truly independent state of all its people.
Well, thanks a lot, Hassan Logat and Dr. Firoz Osman, for your incisive analysis. And now we welcome you on Palestine as we mark the International Quilts Day.
Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my son, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. I've dug the earth with my hands, my bare hands. I've searched for my roots in this soil, this holy land, the land which is yours and which is mine, Palestine. And you, good earth, glorious land, son to you, see, I offer my son to you, only to you. I lifted his head from his mother's arms. I put him on your chest, still in red, to water you. You have my roots, Palestine, 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 Palestine. Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my child, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. Since the story of my anger and your blood, the story of our mother's tears and your brother's cry, to take us on, have to take us on. Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my dear, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. Since somebody inside my aching heart, somebody inside our land, our blood joins in sacrifice, sacrifice. Your blood roots me here, this land, your blood, my heart.
چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. Dear audience, welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from Arab English Radio. This is Zainab Mousavi, and what we do in this program is to listen to certain viewpoints of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi, who was the great founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and then try to shed light and explain some precious points in their view. About independence of the country, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, "We are always ready to defend Islam, the Muslim countries, and their independence." This viewpoint of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi is about the resistance of Iranian people, which led to the sweet status of independence.
Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum.
Political independence is a concept which can be considered to be the highest form of independence in the country, and in fact, its ultimate result. This is because many countries achieve economic and cultural independence, but they try to follow other countries in the political arena. That is why there are few countries like Iran in the world that make their own domestic and international decisions with the highest level of independence and enjoy political independence. Before the victory of the Islamic Revolution, and particularly during Pahlavi's reign, Iran did not have much to say in the area of political independence due to its dependence in domestic and foreign policy. And despite the wishes and endeavors of the people of Iran to achieve political independence, the Pahlavi regime frustrated the Iranians' dream due to its dependent nature. After the frustration of the people of Iran had accumulated for several decades, the mottos, promises, and independent personality of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh gave them the hope of achieving political independence. Subsequently, the Islamic Revolution was established in 1979 on the basis of his independence-seeking message. Basically, the revolution was a collective effort for liberation from dependence and to attain political independence.
Yeah.
Now, after more than 40 years since its establishment, not only has the Islamic Republic of Iran brought the Iranian nation political independence, it has also managed to win the cooperation of many freedom-seeking nations in order to turn the ideal of liberation from dependence and achieving political independence into a public demand in the region. Okay, dear listeners, for ending, let me just recite the sentence of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi about independence of the country. He said, "We are always ready to defend Islam, the Muslim countries, and their independence." Thank you very much for listening to us, and until another episode, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all.
Every night and every day, every night and every day.
There was a spring of truth, a selection of Imam Khomeini's viewpoints.
Never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Mahdi Rastani.
Tonight, inshallah, we want to take some time to delve into the justice of Ali ibn Abi Talib. The narration says someone came and made a claim against Ali. This is while he's Khalifa. Made a claim against Ali, yes? This wealth belongs to me, it doesn't belong to Ali. So he went to the judge. And of course, the judge is appointed by Ali. So the judge was standing there. This person came, he told his story. The judge said, "Oh, Fulan," told him his name. "Tell me what happened." He said, "Yes, this wealth belongs to me. It doesn't belong to Ali," and all of this kind of stuff. The judge then turned to Ali. Now imagine, this is technically his boss that he's bringing to court. So he turned to Ali, he said, "Ya Abul Hasan, why don't you tell us your side of the story? Go and stand beside this man who's making this claim against you and tell us your side of the story." And all of a sudden they saw Ali is frustrated. He's not happy. He said, "What happened, Ya Ali? It's not a problem." He said, "No, I'm not upset that you asked me to go stand beside this man. I'm upset because when you called his name, you just used his name. When you called me, you used my title. That is for showing affection. That is for showing praise. You're the judge. You're not supposed to speak to people in different ways. You called me, you should have said, Ya Ali. Not Ya Abul Hasan. Of course I'm the Khalifa. You're already biased. You can't do that. This is the justice that Ali used to try to implement within society. When it came to his own lifestyle, he used to say in his khutbas, if I wanted to, I could have had the best of lifestyles. I could have had the best and the finest of silk as my clothing. And I could have had the best of water brought to me and the best of crystals that I could drink from. And I could have had the best of meals prepared for me, the chicken and the meat that you all eat. He said, I could have had that for myself too if I wanted to take from Baytul Mal extra. That's injustice. He said, but you know why I don't do this? I don't do this because I don't want to meet the Prophet on the Day of Judgment. And he looks at me and he says, you betrayed one of my ummah. He said, I would rather sleep on a bed made of the thorns of the desert than to meet the Prophet. And he looks at me and he says, you took wealth from one of my nation. This is Ali. This is the one who you and I almost cannot even understand. His justice seems extreme to us. But Ali kept explaining why he was so sensitive on this issue of justice. He said, you know why I don't take from the wealth of the yatim or ghayrul yatim or non-yatim? He said, because every time I want to take from the wealth of a yatim, I want to do injustice to someone, I am reminded by this body of mine that's already falling apart. I'm not going to be here forever. My body's already falling apart. And I'm reminded of that place that I'm going to go under dirt and I will remain there forever. And even if I live a long life, at the end of the day, I'm going to have to meet God. Every time I want to take from the wealth of this person or that person, I am reminded of this. So we read these lines of Ali. And we say, mashallah, wonderful, what a great imam. He never took from the wealth of anyone. But the problem is, injustice is not just taking from the wealth of others. Injustice is when you trample on the rights of others. Sometimes it's wealth. Now you and I might live in a part of the world where, alhamdulillah, we live comfortable lives. Our test is not always wealth. And for most of us sitting here, the majority of us, our test is not wealth. The majority of us, our test is how we treat each other. So I ask you, you look at Ali, he says, I don't touch this wealth because it reminds me of this body of mine that's already falling apart. I already know I'm going to have to respond and answer for what I do. So I ask you now, yes, is it justice in our houses, in our communities, in our cultures? Is it justice this wife comes into the house, she gets married, wonderful, yes, the wedding with the 34 other ceremonies that we typically have for the weddings. Is it justice she comes into this house and then all of a sudden she's responsible for A to Z in this house? She has to wash, she has to clean, she has to scrub, she has to take care of the kids, she has to do homework for the kids, she has to take care of the groceries, she has to take the kids to the school, she has to do the... Is this justice? Is this what Ali taught us? It's not what Ali taught us. Is it justice in our households? You will find this, and I've heard this many times. Is it justice in our households? This young woman, this young daughter of this household, she has 101 restrictions on her. Where you go, what time you go, who you spend time with, how you do this, how you do that, all of this kind of stuff, yes? And some of these restrictions are valid and they are important. But then this young man in the house, the son in the house, no, alhamdulillah, he can do as he wishes. He can come whenever he wants to come. He can go whenever he wants to go. He can dress however he wants to dress. He can communicate with whoever he wants to go. However you like. Then God forbid this young boy washes one dish in the house. Then all of a sudden, mashallah, your wife is going to be so lucky. I'm here to give you some bad news. He's going to have to do a lot more than just washing one dish when he gets married. And then we say, yes, our youth are not interested in marriage. Well, maybe they've seen something for the past 30 years in their houses. Now they say, I don't want a part of that. That's not the only reason, and I want to be clear about this, but this is definitely one of the reasons. I know that for sure. Is it justice in your house, your mother and father who gave everything for you, their lives, years, then they come and tell you something, then all of a sudden you walk away like you're a king. You slam that door, you walk inside as if you're somebody in this house. Is this justice? Is this what Ali taught you? The God of Ali is the same God that exists today. The rules of God are the same rules. If Ali says injustice brings this type of punishment, it will bring that type of punishment for you and I too. It's not like the rules changed. It's the same God. It's the same rules. It's the same standards. Is it justice, brothers and sisters, in our households? These fathers come home, these mothers come home. All of a sudden, you see in some households, the kids, they start to shake, tremble. Why? What happens? Our parent came home. Because the moment this father or mother comes home, the kids know. All fun is done. Now, the only thing you can do is dodge the bullets of getting into trouble. Why is this here? Why is that there? Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? What are you watching? Shut it down. All fun is shut down now all of a sudden. Terrible akhlaq. Is this justice? Is this what Ahlul Bayt taught us? I come into the house like this, like a king. This is, Ali ibn Abi Talib said, listen, when you're going at it and you are speaking to someone and you're doing injustice to them, remember your body and how it's already falling apart. You're going to be held accountable. The justice of Ahlul Bayt extends to all areas of the life of the human being. Is it justice this husband comes home, he's been providing, he's been doing whatever he can, and then this wife turns around and says, yes, you know, Fulani's husband got them this. If you were more of a man, you would have been able to get this for us. Is this justice? This is not justice. And these injustices, brothers and sisters, I'm not saying it, Ali is saying it, we will be held accountable to these. And if we find these in our homes, the only way to go about it is to repent to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala quickly. Quickly. Why does it have to take you 10 years to then come back and apologize? Why not 10 minutes? This is why Ali kept going back to the issue of justice.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Alim Halim Hakim Matin.
Soba International Media Festival.
Part 2.
In a world saturated with an overwhelming deluge of information, documentary cinema stands as a beacon of truth. It cuts through the noise of mainstream media, offering profound insights and authentic narratives that challenge our perceptions. I am Bahman Urai, your host, and in this episode, I'm thrilled to delve into the art of documentary filmmaking with an artist whose work has not only illuminated hidden realities, but also inspired critical conversations. Mostafa Raza Karimi, born in 1946 in Iran, is a prominent director, producer, and writer. He studied architecture in Austria before transitioning to the film industry in 1974. Karimi has directed and written scripts for several notable films, including The Grand Lady of Iran, The Hidden Sense, and Ahmad. His work often explores complex social and cultural themes, earning him recognition in Iranian cinema. Mr. Mostafa Razak Karimi, very good to have you on the program. Always a pleasure for us. How do you ensure the accuracy in the information presented in your film? Because especially when it's posthumous, it's very difficult to verify. What is your verification procedure while making the film, while researching the film?
No matter who the narrator is, making a documentary is more challenging than writing a novel. This is because the investigation must be in video form and should not reflect any exaggerations. In the documentary about the Great Lady of Iran, the music is intangible. The composer expressed to me that our hearts are heavy with sorrow and all we can do is cry. I responded that we wanted to show the pain of this lady and her husband in other ways. At the end of the film, she says, "I will be alone at home." I told the composer, "This challenge is for you to handle. Go and do whatever you can with your instruments." This is true documentary filmmaking.
Well, this was a turning point in your career. And the way that you dealt with the film, with your subject, was very impressive. And it kind of changed the impression of war for so many people. Even watching a short clip of it still gets overwhelming to you. I remember that you had an interview at the time and you said that the issue of victims of chemical weapons is a global one. How did this become your concern? Tell us about that.
It was entirely accidental. A friend called to inform me about the arrival of Iranian chemical casualties. I had never heard of such an incident before. They asked if I could film it. It was just that simple. I talked with the Iran ambassador, Mr. Qiarashi, in Austria, who was in office in that time. I hadn't any clue about what chemical casualty means. I thought this is only another film. That night, Professor Freilinger and his wife, the Iran ambassador, and I were waiting at the airport. The plane was supposed to land at 9 o'clock, but hours passed without any sign of it, leaving us worried. The Boeing 747 landed at 2:30 and taxied to a hidden location out of sight. We had to wear masks before we could enter the plane. As I stepped inside, I saw a flight attendant crying and was confronted with a scene I had not expected. It felt like cinema without seats, with them lying on the floor, moaning in pain and suffering. It was shocking. Some of them passed away right there on the plane. I was aware this was a covert flight, but when I spoke with the captain, he told me that it was a trouble-free journey. However, he mentioned this was only our first stop with several other countries ahead. We spent the entire night dividing the patients among three or four hospitals. By the end of night, I almost collapsed. The sight was deeply disturbing. Blisters covered all their bodies, many of which were infected. That night, Vienna, renowned for its waltz music, was filled with the haunting moans of these injured men, which was profoundly moving. I volunteered to be their translator. The news was widely broadcast, though some countries like Austria censored it. Nevertheless, people around the world became aware of what had happened. Then Austrian Security Service placed Professor Freilinger in quarantine. They were saying that Freilinger had brought some Iranian corpses, and it was unclear whether this was truly the work of Saddam. The Germans were spreading the news. However, Professor Freilinger stood his ground bravely against the Germans and the Dutch. They even stole one of his important documents during a meeting. All in all, the film was shown in many places. Mr. Parviz Parastui was amazed by the crowd that came to watch it. The film was a heartfelt creation, not something showy. My aim was to demonstrate their innocence against the brutality of their attackers and to reveal the hidden reality to the world, a reality that remained concealed until 2007. Later, during Saddam's trial in 2007, it was confirmed that he was responsible for the chemical warfare.
I'm going to now talk about your latest film, Ahmad. Well, you know, I have a personal connection to this film. I did the English subtitles on this, so I was so proud of it.